Lecture 9 of the Foundations of Human Experience, the Synopsis. The first three seven-year periods of life. The three aspects of logical thinking: conclusion, judgment, concept. Healthy conclusions live only in completely awake aspects of life. The descent of judgment into the dreaming soul and concepts into the sleeping soul. Development of the habits of the soul through the type of judging. The effects of concepts which have descended into the sleeping soul upon the formation of the body, in particular the uniform common physiognomies. The necessity of living concepts, characterizations instead of definitions. Flexible and fixed concepts, the structure of a human idea. The child's unconscious basic tenor: 1. In the first 7 years, quote, the world is moral, unquote, and therefore to be imitated. The impulse of the prenatal past. 2. In the second 7 year period, quote, the world is beautiful, unquote, life in art, enjoyment of the present. 3. In the third 7 year period, quote, the world is true, unquote, systematic instruction and an impulse toward the future. End of synopsis. Lecture 9, given in Stuttgart, August 30th, 1919. If you fill your deep understanding of the developing human being with will and feeling, then you will teach well. A pedagogical instinct will awaken in you that will enable you to apply what comes from your will-permeated knowledge of child development. However, that knowledge must be real. That is, it must be based on a true understanding of the human of the actual world. To reach a real knowledge of the human being, we have attempted to visualize the human being first from the viewpoint of the soul and then from that of the spirit. We want to recall that a spiritual comprehension of the human being requires that we reflect upon the various levels of consciousness. We need to realize that, at least at first, our spiritual life takes place in waking, dreaming, and sleeping, and that we may view individual events in life as occurring in fully awake, dreaming, or sleeping states. Now we will try to slowly shift our attention from the spirit down through the soul to the physical body, so that we can have the whole human being before us. Finally, we can finish our discussions with what is health-giving to children. You know that the stage of life under consideration for teaching as a whole is the first 2 decades. You also know that the entire life of children in these first 2 decades is divided into 3 parts. Until the time of the change of teeth, children have a certain character that they express in their desire to be imitative beings. Children try to imitate everything they see. From the age of 7 until puberty, everything the child wants to know, feel, and do is based upon a desire to receive it from authorities. Only after puberty do children begin to want to relate to their environment through their own judgment. We must therefore take into account that when we have elementary school-age children before us, we must develop human beings whose innermost essence strives toward authority. If we are not able to teach out of authority during the stage of life, we will be poor teachers. Nevertheless, we now want to acquire an overview of the spiritual characteristics of human life. As we have already described from the most varied points of view, the full activity of human life encompasses cognitive thinking on the one side, willing on the other, and feeling in the middle. Between birth and death, earthly human beings depend upon slowly imbuing cognitive thinking with logic, and with everything that enables them to think logically. However, as teachers, you will have to keep what you know about logic in the background, since logic is something very academic. You should teach it to the children only through your bearing. However, as teachers, you must carry the most important elements of logic within you. When we act logically, that is, when we act in a thinking, cognitive manner, this activity always exists in three parts. First, in our thinking cognition, we always have what we call conclusions. Normally, we express thinking in speech. If you look at the structure of speech, you will find that when you speak, you continually create conclusions. In human beings, the most conscious activity is that of forming conclusions. People could not express themselves through language if they did not continually speak of conclusions, and they could not understand others if they did not continually receive conclusions. Theoretical logic usually dissects conclusions and thereby falsifies the conclusions that occur in normal life. Theoretical logic does not take into account that we draw a conclusion when we look at something. Imagine going into a zoo and seeing a lion. What is the first thing you do when you perceive the lion? First, you become conscious of what you see as a lion. Only through becoming conscious do you come to terms with your perception of the lion. Before going to the zoo, you already learned that things that look like the lion you are looking at are, quote-unquote, animals. What you learned in life, you bring to the zoo. Then you look at the lion and realize that it does what you have learned animals do. You connect this with what you have already learned in life and then form the judgment that the lion is an animal. Only when you have formed this judgment do you understand the specific concept lion. First, you form a conclusion. Second, you make a judgment. And finally, you arrive at a concept. Of course, you do not know that you continually practice this. However, if you did not, you could not lead a conscious life that enables you to communicate with other humans through language. People normally believe that humans arrive first at concepts. That is not true. In life, the conclusion is first. If we do not arrive at the zoo with a concept of lion, but instead add our new perception of the lion to our other experiences, then the first thing we do at the zoo is to draw a conclusion. We must be clear that when we go to the zoo and see a lion, this is only a single deed in the context of the remainder of life. We do not begin life when we go to the zoo and look at a lion. We connect that act to everything previous in life, and everything previous in life plays a role. On the other hand, what we experience in the zoo, we take into the remainder of life. If we now consider the entire process, what is the lion first? First, it is a conclusion. A little later, the lion is a judgment. Finally, somewhat later, the lion is a concept. If you open textbooks on logic, particularly older ones, you will normally find among the conclusions described one that is particularly well known. All people are mortal. John is a person. Therefore, John is mortal. John is certainly the most famous person in logic. This separation of the three judgments, quote-unquote, all people are mortal and John is a person, therefore John is mortal, in fact occurs only in the teaching of logic. In life, these three judgments are interwoven and are one, because life progresses in a thinking, cognitive way. You always make all three of these judgments simultaneously when you meet John. You include all three judgments in what you think about him. Thus, the conclusion exists first. Then you form a judgment stated in the formal, quote-unquote, conclusion, quote, therefore John is mortal, unquote. The last thing that you have is the specific concept of, quote, the mortal John, unquote. These three things, conclusion, judgment, concept, exist in cognition, that is, in the living human spirit. How do they behave in the living human spirit? Conclusions can live and be healthy only in the living human spirit. That is, the conclusion is healthy only when it exists in completely conscious life. That is very important, as we will see later. For that reason, you ruin children's souls if you have the children memorize finished conclusions. What I now have to say about teaching is of fundamental importance when we have to act in a given instance. In the Waldorf school, you will have children of all ages with the results of their previous education. Other teachers have worked with these children, and you will find the results in conclusion, judgment, and concept. You will need to have the children recall what they know, since you cannot begin with each child anew. We have the peculiar circumstance that we cannot build the school from the bottom up, but instead must immediately begin with 8 grades. You will find before you the souls of children taught by others, and you must be careful in the beginning to avoid forcing the children to retrieve finished conclusions from their memory. If those finished conclusions have been laid too strongly in their souls, then it is better to let them lie, and now try to allow the children to focus upon concluding. Judgments first develop, of course, in fully awake life. However, judgments can descend into the human soul, where the soul dreams. Conclusions should never trickle down to the dreaming soul, only judgments. But everything we make in the way of judgments about the world trickles down into the dreaming soul. What is this dreaming soul really? As we have learned, it is more feeling-oriented. When we form a judgment and then go on with our lives, we carry our judgments with us through the world. However, we carry them in the feeling, and that means judging is a kind of habit. You form children's soul habits through the way you teach them to judge. You must be completely conscious of this. Sentences are the expressions of judgment, and with each sentence you say to the children, you add one more building block to the habit life of the children's souls. Therefore, a teacher with real authority should be conscious that what he or she says clings to the habit life of the children's souls. If we now go from judgment to concept, we must admit that what we develop as concepts descends into the deepest depths of human nature, and, considered spiritually, descends into the sleeping soul. Concepts descend into the sleeping soul, and this is the soul that works on the body. The wakeful soul does not work on the body. The dreaming soul does, to a limited extent, creating what is expressed in habitual gestures. However, the sleeping soul is active right into the form of the body. When you create concepts, that is, when you provide the results of judgments, you act upon the sleeping soul right into the children's bodies. The human body is all but completed when a person is born. The soul can at most refine what inheritance has already provided. Nevertheless, it does refine it. We go through the world and look at people. We see that people have distinct facial features. What do these facial features embody? Among other things, they carry the results of all the concepts taught them in childhood. All the concepts poured into the child's soul shine back at us from the face of the mature person, because, among other things, the sleeping soul has formed the adult's facial features in conformity with the concepts retained by the soul. Here we can see the consequence of our teaching. Through the formation of concepts, our teaching leaves its imprint on the person right down into the body. An observable modern phenomenon is people with decidedly bland faces. Hermann Bahr once expressed that in a Berlin lecture about his experience, Hermann Bahr once expressed that in a Berlin lecture about his experiences. He said that during the 1890s, if you were to walk through the streets in the Rhine or around Essen and meet people coming from the factories, you would get the vague feeling that there were no differences between the people you met. You would feel as if you only met copies of one person, that it was actually not possible to distinguish between people. That is an important observation, and Bahr made another observation that is also quite important. He said that if you were invited to supper in Berlin in the 1890s and were seated between two women, you could actually not distinguish between them, but you at least had one difference, namely that one would be to the left, the other to the right. If you were then invited somewhere else, it could occur that you could not tell if a woman there was the woman from yesterday or the one from the day before. In other words, there is a certain uniformity among people. That is a sure sign that people were not properly raised. From such things we must learn what is necessary to transform the educational system, because education goes so deeply into civilization. Concepts live unconsciously in people when they go through life without being confronted by a single fact. Concepts live in the unconscious. Judgments can live only as habits in semi-conscious dreaming. And conclusions should actually be present only in the fully conscious waking life. This means that while we must be very careful to speak with children about everything connected with conclusions, we should not provide them with finished conclusions, but only allow them to retain what will ripen into a concept with maturity. What do we need for this? Imagine you form concepts, and these concepts are dead. Then you inoculate children with conceptual corpses. If you inoculate children with dead concepts, you inject the corpses of concepts right into their physical bodies. What does a concept need to be like when we teach it to children? It must be living if children are to live with it. Children must live, and therefore concepts must also live. If you inoculate 9 or 10-year-old children with concepts that will remain the same when those children are 30 or 40 years old, then you inoculate them with the corpses of concepts, because the concept cannot evolve as the children develop. You must teach the children concepts that can evolve throughout their lives. The teacher must be mindful to give children the kinds of concepts that can evolve in life. When the children are older, those concepts will not be the same as when they were received then. When you do this, you inoculate children with living concepts. When do you inoculate them with dead concepts? When you continually give them definitions. When you say, quote, a lion is blank parenthesis, or excuse me, quotation mark, and have them memorize this, then you inoculate children with dead concepts. You assume that when the children are 30 years old, they will have exactly the same concepts you now teach. This means that continual defining is the death of living instruction. Then what must we do? In teaching, we should not define. We should attempt to characterize. We characterize when we look at things from as many points of view as possible. If we teach children conventional natural history, for example, then we only define animals. We must try to portray animals from different standpoints in the various areas of instruction. For example, from the standpoint of how people came to understand an animal, how people use the animal's work, and so forth. Rationally formed instruction can characterize if you do not simply describe a squid, and then again later a mouse, and again later human beings, parenthesis, during the corresponding blocks of instruction, parenthesis, but rather place the squid, mouse, and human being next to each other and relate them to one another. In this case, these relationships are so manifold that no single definition emerges, but rather a portrayal. From the very beginning, appropriate instruction works not toward definitions, but toward characterization. It is particularly important that we always be aware not to kill anything in children, but to teach them so that they remain lively and do not dry out and become stiff. When you teach children, you must carefully differentiate between concepts that are flexible and those, and they do exist, that do not need to change. The latter concepts can give children a kind of framework in their souls. Of course, in this case, you must remember to give children something that can remain for the rest of life. You may not give children dead, unchanging concepts about the details of life. You must give them living concepts about the specifics of life and the world, concepts that develop organically with the children. However, you must relate everything to the human being. In the end, everything in the children's comprehension must stream together into their concept of the human being. The concept of the human being may remain. Everything you provide children, when you tell them a story and relate it to humans, when you relate the squid and the mouse to humans in natural history, when you excite a feeling of wonder for the telegraph that is completed by the ground wire, all of these are things that connect the whole world in its details to the human being. This is something that can remain. We form the concept of human being only slowly. We cannot teach children a finished concept of human beings. However, when it is completed, it may remain. It is, indeed, the most beautiful thing a child can take from school into later life. Namely the concept, the most multifaceted, most comprehensive concept of the human being. What lives in human beings tends toward metamorphosis. If you can bring it about that the children have concepts of respect and honoring, concepts of all that we can call in an all-encompassing sense a prayerful attitude, then such thoughts will be living in children, permeated with a prayerful attitude, and will remain into old age. In old age, these concepts will be transformed into a capacity to bless and to give others the results of a prayerful attitude. I once said that no elderly person who did not properly pray as a child would really be able to bless in old age. Older people can only properly bless, that is, with the greatest strength, if they properly prayed as children. To teach concepts that are intimately connected with human nature means to give children living concepts. These living concepts undergo metamorphosis, transforming themselves throughout people's lives. Now let us look at the threefold nature of youthful life from a somewhat different standpoint. Until the time of the change of teeth, children want to imitate. Until the time of puberty, they want to stand under authority. And then they want to use their judgment in the world. We can express this somewhat differently. What do human beings actually desire when they arrive from the spirit-soul world and clothe themselves with bodies? Human beings want to bring what they previously lived through in the spiritual world to the reality of the physical world. Before the change of teeth, human beings are, in a sense, focused upon the past. Human beings are still filled with the devotion developed in the spiritual world. For this reason, they focus upon their surroundings by imitating people. What, then, is the basic impulse, the still completely unconscious tenor of children before the change of teeth? This attitude is something very beautiful that we must nurture. It is something that arises from an unconscious belief, namely that the world is moral. This is not completely true of modern souls, however, when people enter the world. Because they are physical beings, there is a tendency to begin with an unconscious belief, namely the world is moral. Until the change of teeth, and to an extent beyond, it is good for education that we take this unconscious belief into account. I took this into account when I presented two readings, and showed that the preparation for them lives completely in the assumption of morality. In the piece about the shepherd's dog, the butcher's dog, and the lap dog, human morals are reflected in the animal world. For Hoffmann von Fallersleben's poem about the violet, I attempted to bring morality, without pedantry, to children over 7 by taking into account the supposition that the world is moral. That children are a human race who still believes in the morality of the world, and therefore believes they may imitate the world, is precisely what is so uplifting and wonderful about them. Children live so much in the past, and in many respects reveal not the physical but the prenatal, the spirit-soul past. After human beings have gone through the change of teeth, they actually live constantly in the present, and until puberty are interested in things of the present. In teaching, we must always take into account that elementary school children always want to live in the present. How do people live in the present, then? We live in the present when we enjoy the world in a human, as opposed to an animalistic way. It is quite true that elementary school children want to enjoy the world in school also. We should not miss the opportunity to teach in such a way that the education is something that is rather enjoyable for children, not animalistically enjoyable, but enjoyable in a higher human sense, and not something that evokes antipathy and repulsion. Pedagogy has made all kinds of good attempts in this area. However, there is also something dangerous here. The danger is that when we try to use the idea that teaching should be a source of joy, it can easily be distorted into something mundane, and that should not occur. We can only avoid that when, as teachers, we always want to raise ourselves above the mundane, the pedantic, the narrow-minded. We can accomplish this only if we maintain a living relationship to art. We make a particular assumption if we wish to enjoy the world humanly and not animalistically, namely that the world is beautiful. From the time of the change of teeth until puberty, children also unconsciously assume that they may find the world to be beautiful. We do not, in truth, take into account this unconscious assumption of children that the world is beautiful, and that, therefore, education must be beautiful if we think we may teach in a banal fashion, from the sole standpoint of utility, and make up rules for teaching through demonstration. Instead, we must attempt to delve into artistic experience so that we permeate education, particularly in this time, with the artistic. We can certainly become sad when we read modern instruction manuals and see how the good intentions people have to make education a source of joy do not come to fruition when what the teachers say to the children makes such an unaesthetic and mundane impression. Today people love to practice illustrative teaching according to the Socratic method. However, the questions that are put to the children have the character of superficial utilitarianism and not the character of something living in beauty. Here, all the examples in the world are useless. It is useless to tell teachers that they should choose their examples through this or that method. Examples are useful only when teachers draw upon their own relationship to art in selecting tasteful things to speak about to the children. Before the change of teeth, children's lives take place with the unconscious belief that the world is moral. The second period, from the change of teeth until puberty, occurs with the unconscious presumption that the world is beautiful. The first time moral, this time beautiful. Okay. It is only at puberty that a tendency begins to develop to find the world true. Only then can instruction take on a quote-unquote systematized quality. Before puberty, it is not wise to offer systematized instruction, because children have a correct inner concept of truth only following puberty. In this manner, you will come to the insight that the developing child brings the past from the higher worlds into this physical world, and that, following the change of teeth, the present comes alive in the elementary school child. You will realize that people then enter a stage of life when impulses for the future take root in their souls. Past, present, and future, and the life in them. This is what exists in the growing human being. We want to stop here now, and in 2 days continue with this discussion that will more and more enter into practical teaching. The end of Lecture 9.